Hello, world. This is the Know Your Place podcast, and we're on episode 48. And we're also in our first really official episode of 2019, although our last one kind of was, but I guess we finally turned over to a new leaf. Yes, so on this week's episode, I sort of am rehashing an older topic from one of my earlier episodes with new focus. And when you get about 50 episodes in, you, of course, have to kind of do this to an extent. Not to a huge extent, but to a certain extent. So very early on, like my third or fourth episode, I talked about, I think it was six novels that were from two different periods in French history and used those periods as a setting, and how I found them very fascinating in describing the way things were. Well, on this week's episode, I thought, why not talk about certain things from British culture that have really struck me as a strong influence of the way I think about place of these certain places. And again, I want to stress here that, part of making a good setting for these things that are successful things is using place, You got to describe the earth you're talking about to make it interesting to people. And that's why I think these particular things have struck me so much. So the first thing I wanted to talk about is a novel by one of my favorite, if not my favorite authors, which is Graham Greene. And I'm sure a lot of people have heard about him, but there's maybe people who haven't anymore. His stuff is starting to finally become out of date. But basically, he was a writer who also worked for MI5 for a short amount of time and for newspapers, and he traveled across the world and wrote a lot of quasi-spy novels before Ian Fleming got famous. And what's really funny is he references Ian Fleming in some of his stuff and makes fun of him. It's quite silly. But and he wrote stuff all the way up to the 80s. And the biggest thing that I think is impressive about Graham Greene was his one novel that he wrote that was very critical of the Haitian government at the time. It was Papa Doc Duval. It was, I can't remember what it was called. The Comedians, that's what it was called. And this is in even the 80s. He got a book banned and got a huge warning in the UN and all this kind of stuff, even in the 80s, after having written very successful stuff in the 30s and the 40s and still writing for all those years. It's very impressive. And of course, his most famous works are ones like The End of the Affair and The Quiet American and Our Man in Havana and The Power and the Glory. But today I'm going to talk about a sort of lesser known book from his that I absolutely love, and it's called Brighton Rock. And the reason why I love this book, even though it's a bit more amateurish compared to some of his books, even if it is, it's still an amazing book in my opinion, but it's because he sets a place. He very strongly sets a place, and it's Brighton. Now, before I read this book, I hadn't even heard of Brighton, which is shameful because I now know two of my favorite bands are from there. And I actually know somebody on Facebook now who's from there. But, it's the seaside town with a pier, not that far a ride from London, but a bit, it's not in greater London, why do I like this setting so much? Well, it reminds me a bit of my childhood, I guess. Okay, so I'm from Wisconsin, as I've said before on several times here. Well, I was born in Wisconsin. Now I live in Kentucky. But my family is from a town in Wisconsin that is on Lake Michigan. And, there are often times I miss being near the lake. I miss seeing the clear blue water, hearing the ships sometimes, although there's a lot less ships now than there used to be. But, just being near the waves and the pier and all that kind of stuff. And why I like stuff that, and there's a couple other things I've read every once in a while that are somewhat set in sort of waterfront towns in England is, in particular, often in the United States, when we talk about the beach or a waterfront town, we're talking about somewhere warm, like California or Florida. Sometimes we talk about Jersey Shore, and even then, that's still, you know, that's not like Wisconsin, okay? It's not as cold, okay? And I'm not even implying England is as cold, because it's not as cold as Wisconsin. But it is colder than California or Florida. So I feel a more strong kindred spirit connection to that than I do to people talking about songs going out in the sun. And it's, yeah, not to say there's not sun in Wisconsin on the beach, and you don't, I've not been to the beach in the sun on a nice day in Wisconsin, but, you know, I more have a connection to the water of just, it's a utilitarian shipping purpose, not quite the whimsical, carefree beach lifestyle that some other people have to it. So I love this Brighton book because in Brighton, there's a big pier that's been there a long time. And in my parents' hometown, there's also a pier. Granted, it's not famous and it doesn't have a bunch of stuff on it like Brighton does. But hearing the kids, hearing these different scenes of running around on the pier and these different little hotels and alleyways where these people were hanging out and hatching their plans and things like that, and this restaurant near the pier and a bar near the pier, it really brought a lot of nostalgia to me, and I think that's part of the reason why I love the book so much. And then there's a scene where they sort of start driving out to the country trying to find some bar or something, or trying to get away from town, and sort of this driving out down the roads through the countryside along the waterfront. It reminds me of when I was a kid in Wisconsin, and we would drive instead of taking the interstate. Sometimes when we would go out to eat or go out to places, we would just drive along the lakeshore road and see these farms and these crossroads along the lake, you know, Lake Michigan. And for everybody who doesn't know, although I'm assuming most people who listen to this podcast are at least geographically aware enough to understand, Lake Michigan is not some pond, okay? You know, you can't see to the other side of it, you know, things like that. But yeah, so, yeah, I miss that sometimes. I miss it a lot. And I really kind of missed it when I read this book. Even though the book's kind of dark, it is a little bit dark of a book. But hey, what are you going to do? So the second thing I want to talk about is something that even hits me more in this nostalgia and strikes back even farther. And it's a song. Now, I could talk about several songs from the Beatles, and I'm sure I'm going to get a lot of hate for even mentioning the Beatles, because I guess it's not cool to even talk about them anymore. But when I was a kid, and I've still always loved this song since, I was a huge fan of the song Penny Lane. And I love Penny Lane because you just get this snapshot of human life in Liverpool through the eyes of Paul McCartney. And you know, I love a song that starts, tells a story. I'm a big fan of singer-songwriters. I like Jim Croce, and I like stuff like Sheryl Crow and Tom Petty and things like that. So, you know, we get a lot, in America, we have a lot of this type of music, of singer-songwriter type songs. And I guess in England there is some to an extent too, but it's more older folksy songs, not really stuff that gets played on the radio as much, at least not here. But Penny Lane is one of those kind of songs. It's just, I mean, even the title of the song, it's not about, what am I trying to say? Even the title of the song is Penny Lane. It's a road. You already know there's going to be some kind of place attached to it rather than a song like Love Me Do. It's a love song or something, right? You know, it's not like he's just going to mention it in passing. And then the song doesn't even, this is the crazy thing. Nowhere in that song does it make any reference to sort of the typical cliches of what makes a hip-hop song. You know, there's not any references to, well, there are some references to romance and things, but it's not like a love song that just says, how can I make a song so cliche? She left me at Lincoln Station. You know, like, it's not that type of song. You know, all of it is a picture and a snapshot into this area. And as a geographer, when I was a kid, I wasn't a geographer yet, but I think this is part of the reason why I became a geographer was this song purely. because I'm just thinking in there, oh, that's interesting. He's talking about the fireman rushing into the barber shop or the traffic circle. Later I found out it was traffic circle. I wasn't quite exactly sure what he meant when he's talking about the roundabout. And then, you know, just all these different things, you know, and that's cool. I really think that's cool, and I really think it gives you a deep insight into place that we don't usually get from artists. So I enjoyed it very much. And then this other thing I'm going to talk about again, if I could just go into the very stereotypical things that Americans notice about British people. I'm going to talk about Monty Python. And again, I could talk about plenty of sketches from Monty Python that describe places, because they did a very good job of doing that as well in their material. But in the particular one I want to talk about is the Mr. Hilter sketch. And why I want to talk about that is it opens with this scene of sort of some like English, I'm assuming bed and breakfast type of deal, not obviously a hotel, but, you know, just some English parlor with a bread and breakfast. And in there, of course, is the guy who's Mr. Hilter, which is Hitler. It's, you know, the joke. But, and then this, it opens with this other couple coming in talking about all these motorways. They got stuck in traffic in and they had to go around because of road work and the M26 and the M25 or whatever they talk about in there. I don't remember the exact numbers, but you just feel instantly barraged by British culture as an outsider watching this. Now, to be fair, this was originally made for English culture. It was not made to be viewed by Americans, but then again, you know, it's just, it gives you the absolute pitch perfect snapshot of suburban London, I think, at the time period, right? And then, you know, of course, they go into this whole scene and they show him running around trying to strum up a support for a rally, and there's like two people there and they're down the street corner, you know, and they show them interviewing people, seeing how their reaction would be to it. It's a great scene, and it gives you just such a snapshot into that life. And as somebody who's an American who grew up largely in the 90s and early 2000s, you know, if I hadn't seen that sketch and I were trying to think of my concept of what is England, I wouldn't get that picture of that time period. So it's really cool to get. And, you know, I'm sure there's parts of Greater London and other places that are still like that. And it's pretty funny and pretty cool. Okay. So after that, another thing I sort of wanted to go into, and I could go into countless things from the Victorian era, because, you know, that was a very influential, you know, that really shapes the culture of what we think of as British, even today still, I think. There's a lot of stuff from that time period that very much so shapes our impressions of it. But one of the plays I loved a lot as a kid, well, not as a kid, as a high schooler, was The Importance of Being Earnest by Oscar Wilde. And I loved it because it just shows all these different caricatures of what romance was like then and sort of how to be ridiculous and fun all at the same time. And, you know, it just shows the crazy amount of interplay that happened in that time period, you know. And again, it's sort of like it's an era that's gone, but it gives you a snapshot into sort of what it was like at the time period, and sort of why it really helps you sort of see why modern British culture behaves the way it does, getting this caricature of how it was back then. And it has these scenes with parlors and tea and, you know, these men acting ridiculous and trying to marry other, trying to skirt around each other to win women's affection. It's very silly, and I love it. And Wilde wrote a great play. Now we're going to take a sort of, so since I went from dark to feel good, I'll go back to dark again. And I feel like I am just constantly spitting cliches in this episode. But the next one I wanted to talk about is 1984. And the reason why there's so much place for me interlaced in 1984 is because of all the different scenes he has places. Like, he has his apartment, you know, which he goes up all these flares, and he has where the Ministry of Truth is. And then, you know, they find their hideaway, which is some second floor of some rinky-dink shop, you know, and he meets her and the woman in the bushes first, you know, off of a train route somewhere. And I don't know what it is about London that is that apparently makes people want to write dystopian literature, because, you know, the other thing that comes to mind with that to me is they did an episode, Ray Bradbury had a film of Fahrenheit 451 made in London that was also very, you know, it was just, it felt very or very dystopian and whatever. What is it about, I'll have to ask this question to some of my British friends, you know, what is it about London that makes sort of dystopian literature come out? Not to say there isn't other sources too, you know, one of my favorite ones is Russian in nature, but yeah, so I see, that's what I see. I sort of get this impression of a super ultra modern London. And also I got it from the show The Prisoner, you know, because there's scenes where he's trying to get back to London and, you know, the Secret Service, you know, puts him out in this remote village and, you know, it's crazy. It's, there's lots of things that I feel like are slightly dystopian about London. And I don't know why I conjure that image, because I think the image London wants us to conjure of it is one of sort of just the queen on her stately throne and, you know, just trying to get in tourists now and act outrageous. But there's like this weird dark undertone to it, you know. Yeah, and then the last thing I'll finish with talking about is the concept of the Garden Cities of Tomorrow by Sir Ebenezer Howard, and that was written in 1902. And it has had much influence on suburban development and trying to limit urban sprawl, although I don't know how it really can be limited. And this clearly shows us that Bretons in particular are very conscientious about the urban lifestyle and how it may go too far. And instead of reacting in a way of creating these networks of honeycomb cities with parks, as an American, you know, we just gave everybody these, we just all wanted these enormous lots of our own land. And then we end up just selling them and subdividing them anyway and cramming stuff on top of each other. So I don't really have a good answer for that, but it is an interesting concept. And it sort of says a lot about what Britons thought about the urban landscape at the time. So anyway, those are just a few things of what I think of when I think of British culture and how it can be paired with geography and sort of my concept of place. I can pull farther back and more modern, but those are really what I think of. Oh, and another British thing that's sort of set in, makes London look dystopian is, of course, V for Vendetta. You know, that comes to mind for me instantly. So anyway, great topic. Let me know what you all think in the comments section, and thank you for listening. Know your place. Peace.